The exploring of extreme places on the Earth grips our attention even today, but today we have metal ships and heaters and batteries. The story we'll discuss this hour is an exploration of the far north before the year 1600. Dutch navigator William Barents led three voyages to the Arctic Ocean looking for a route to China. I probably don't need to tell you he didn't get there. The Barents Sea is named for him, and that's not usually a good sign. There are many more details contained in a new book by Andrea Pitzer called Icebound, Shipwrecked at the Edge of the World. Andrea Pitzer is a journalist who relishes digging up history long forgotten by the world or perhaps never known. Andrea has also published poetry and is the author of two previous books, including a global history of concentration camps. Andrea Pitzer, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure. How did this particular story come to your attention?
Well, it's kind of weird. My first book was the story of Vladimir Nabokov, the guy who wrote Lolita. Mm-hmm. And about a decade ago, I was reading into the history of these islands north of Russia called Nova Zembla, and I came across the story of William Barents, this explorer from 400 years ago, and it was a story I'd never heard. And I was kind of astounded by it. And I've been thinking about it for more than a decade now.
Well, the last name was instantly recognizable to me. I've looked at enough maps to know about the Kara Sea on one side of Nova Zembla and the Barents Sea on the other side. I assume now it's named for him. What drove him? What biographical details do we know about who he was and why he did the things he did?
Actually, it's kind of an amazing thing. Because it's such an old story, we don't know a lot about his early life. We know that ever since he was a child, he was fascinated by maps. He was the first guy to fully map and publish a book mapping the Mediterranean Sea. And he had a wife. He had five kids. He was affiliated with a geographer that was very famous at the time named Petrus Plancius. And then he was sent on three Arctic missions to the north. And it's really the events of that, rather than sort of his earlier biography, that ended up making him so famous that Shakespeare would refer to him.
Shakespeare referred to Barents?
In The Twelfth Night, there's a moment in which somebody has sort of offended someone else so deeply that another guy says to him, "You have sailed so far north into my lady's regard that you will hang there and sit like an icicle on a Dutchman's beard," and is talking about these guys who literally had to sail just a couple years before that was written. And so it's pretty amazing that, you know, he was from the Netherlands. He wasn't from England, but his exploits, this overwintering where they got stuck and survived so far north, really became kind of an instant legend.
Mm-hmm. All right, so the expedition, I guess we cut to the chase here, the expedition did survive that third icebound mission, but Barents himself did not, is that right?
So basically, yeah, they had started out with two ships, and one thing we do know about Barents is that he was pretty stubborn and can be argumentative, and so the two ships that were on the sort of mini expedition to try to sail from Amsterdam to China in a northeast passage over Russia and Asia, they split, and so Barents and 16 men went on alone, and they were there about 200 or 300 miles north of the Russian mainland at these islands of Nova Zembla, known in Russian as Novaya Zemlya today, and they got stuck in the ice, and they ended up having to overwinter. So the ship got frozen in. They came out and hunted driftwood and peeled off some non-essential parts of the ship and built themselves a cabin to try to hold out for the winter, which is pretty incredible because there were polar bear attacks. There's no vegetation up there. They were already starting to suffer the effects of scurvy. They would poison themselves. Just the stuff they endured day after day was just incredible. And then the trip home, the attempt to get home, which all of them didn't survive, as you noted, it was really just as harrowing as the time they spent on Nova Zembla for the winter.
I want to point out, poison themselves accidentally with bear liver, was it?
Well, yeah, two different times. One time they ate polar bear liver, which it turns out is super, super concentrated with vitamin A, and their skin literally peeled off from head to toe. I thought that was an exaggeration in the journals, but I looked a little bit into the effects of hypervitaminosis A, and it turns out that does in fact happen along with a lot of other bad things. Three guys got really sick and almost died from it.
Wow.
And the other time they burned, they got so cold, they had more than an inch of ice on the inside of their cabin.
Mm-hmm.
They would sit in front of the fire and try to warm their feet, and they wore these sort of stocking tights, and the stockings would catch fire before they could feel the heat of the fire. So, I mean, it was really impossible to keep even the inside of the cabin warm. but they used some ship's coal that they had, and they burned it in their interior fire, and they thought, well, we'll keep it really warm. We'll close up any ventilation. So they stopped up their chimney and shut all the doors and tried to seal the place in. But it turns out that kind of coal releases really toxic fumes, so they almost asphyxiated themselves.
Wow, that's amazing that any of them did survive. But so let's come back to the beginning of this, though. Give us a sense of the political background. By the time that Barents made his first expedition in, what was it, 1596?
1594 was the first. Mm-hmm. About 1594, 1595, and 1596. And the first one, so, like, there's a lot of really interesting geopolitics that are there in that moment, and you've got Spain is running the Netherlands at that point, and the Netherlands has resisted that, and they've said, no, we refuse the king. So they started out just by rejecting monarchy, and then after that, they went on to say, not only will we reject monarchy, we won't pick another king, we will just govern ourselves. Which was really radical. This was before the American Revolution. So this was sort of the pre-American Revolution, inspirational revolution that lots of other people looked to. And so they fought what ended up being an 80-year war with Spain to really secure that independence. And Barents sails out right in the middle of it. So this is not long after they've declared themselves an independent republic. And all these people have fled the southern part of this region into what is now these provinces of this Dutch Republic. And so they have a real concentration of capital and money from people that wanted to flee Spanish control. They've got a really great geographical placement, you know, right on the water in terms of being able to sail, and maritime imperial powers are about to become a huge thing. They have a lot of shipbuilding technology. So they're just itching to get in on all this trade that's happening because Spain and Portugal, you know, Spain and Portugal have basically tried to divide the world between each other or between themselves. And so Spain is bringing back all this silver and gold from the Americas, and the Portuguese are running routes south around Africa at this point, and so there is trade coming in from the east. And the Dutch are trying to figure out, how can we get in on this?
So the political and economic upheaval with Spain and Portugal trying to divide the world between themselves in the 1590s presents an opportunity for this this proclaimed Dutch Republic. And essentially, as you point out in the book, Barents benefited from the chaos.
Yeah, the countries were looking for a way to get rich and get in on this trade. And the idea had been around since the Greeks that maybe there was just a ring of ice like at the bottom of the Arctic Circle. And if you could just break through that, there would be an open sea. And they understood that the world was a globe. And so the idea you might kind of head north to come back down on the other side of the world and take a shortcut to China was very tempting. And if they went north instead of south, they wouldn't end up battling with Spain and Portugal. So it was very tempting to try to find that northern route for them.
Interesting. Sort of like Columbus with the idea of sailing west to get to the east, and this is going north to get to the south or something.
Well, north to get to the east, but yeah, avoiding all the enemies, avoiding all the fights for sure.
Mm-hmm. So, and you mentioned that the tales of this passage went as far back as the Greeks, the ancient Greeks?
Yeah, there were a lot of, and it's a little hard to sort out what they were serious about and what was sort of, you know, mythic, but there were ideas that it was so warm up there because it was exposed to the sun. You know, the idea was that it would be like closer to the sun. They would have these endless days. They understood that there would be these, these white nights. But they thought that maybe meant you could have two crops a year, and that there were gentle giants that lived up there and just like hung out and were like low key in all the heat. So it was really not clear, but that idea had been around for a couple thousand years.
Wow. There must have been somebody, at least a few people, who said, no, it just gets colder as you go further north.
Well, yeah. There's a reason not everybody tried to go north, but there was an idea that if you could, you know, there might be better or worse regions, or if you could, as they did on their second expedition, sort of skirt closer to the Russian coastline. So this long strip of kind of two large islands that mostly make up Nova Zembla, where they ended up overwintering, is kind of like a folded-up hot dog almost. Mm-hmm. And the bottom part of it is not very far from the mainland. So on that second expedition, they thought, well, we won't go as far north as trying to go over those islands. North of them, we'll go underneath them. And so there was a thought that maybe if you stuck close enough to the coastline that you could work your way through. But actually, the second expedition was even sort of more of a disaster than the first.
I have to admit, the more I read the book and the longer I looked at the maps, it was like, well, you know, maybe if you did stick to the coast, the ice wouldn't form as well and you could get through. But, you know, obviously, no such luck there. How had there been efforts before Barents from Western Europe to try to head this way?
There were. There were some British efforts. There were some Dutch efforts in terms of funding some people. Even King Henry before that at one point had sent supposedly two ships due north to just try to find out what was up there. And reports were that one was lost and that one came back. And we just don't know a lot more than that. But there were these efforts that had sort of tried to do this route before. And what those ended up establishing were trade with, sort of competitive trade, with the Duke of Moscow. So the Grand Duke of Moscow ended up having trade through this port of Archangel that, if you know anything about, let's say, World War I history, became a very important port in northern Russia for the West. And it's those roots of the Western sort of trade through there go all the way back to this era. Just before Barents, that trade had been established. And so it was a little dicey, actually, when he would be coming around Scandinavia and heading into those Russian waters. He gets badgered at points by customs officials, and there's definitely the Danes are involved. So Europe is already sort of jockeying for that stuff that's really close to Europe on the Russian side there. But once you get over Siberia and below Nova Zembla, there's some indigenous Nenets herders that they run into and some Russian fishermen, but the ice is just such that nobody is able to get anywhere near as far north on Nova Zembla as Barents was able to on two of his three voyages.
So describe the ships that Barents assembled for his first voyage and their seaworthiness.
Well, it's we have an incomplete record because this was an artisanal age of shipbuilding. So there are no ship plans. There are no photos, obviously. But we do have a pretty good amount of information in what was written in the logs. And on the first trip, they ended up with two teams, if you will. There was going to be some of them were going to split after they got around Scandinavia. And some of them were going to go for that southern route and stick close to the coastline and see if there might be a way through. This was sort of a scouting expedition. And then Barents, with one large ship and a small sort of scouting vessel, were going to go north. And the question that they wanted to find out at that time was whether Nova Zembla was actually part of some huge polar continent, because that was in the running as well. But, of course, these boats were made out of wood. They were, you know, constantly getting water in them, and they would have to be pumped out. They were not using chains. They were using rope. So a lot of the things that we even think of for wood ships, tall ships that maybe you've seen pictures of, things were really rudimentary. On the other hand, the sails, the styles of sails that were on them were not that different than things we would see later. But the Dutch made these great innovations with a ship that was called a fluit, which would take tons and tons and tons of cargo. But that's not what Barents sailed with. He wasn't sort of getting the A-team brand-new boats that were just out of the shipyard. Their boats were a few years old. So they were just dowdy, small to mid-size ships with a couple decks. There is a replica of that they're building. They're just finishing it now in the Netherlands, of the ship that he sailed on his third voyage. And I was able to go into that replica. And so I can tell you that basically there's a cargo hold at the bottom. There's the middle level, the orlop, where they would be sleeping. And that's where the cannons were, because, of course, they did think that they might run into, they might have to be in an offensive or a defensive position at some point with Spain. And then there's the top deck. So it's not a big boat, about 60 feet long, and a little fatter and lower than a 60-foot-long boat that you would use for a pleasure cruise would be. But they were called yachts then, and they're not terribly different than what we would have as yachts now, but again, a little thicker and fuller through the bottom, and of course made out of wood.
Well, 60 feet, that is not a big ship by any stretch of the imagination. And it's interesting, though, that we know the names of the ships in the other squadron, the two separate squadrons, Mercury and Swan, but don't even know the names of Barents' ship and its companion. In addition to asking about the replica, I wanted to ask about the ship's logs. Are those completely intact from all three of the missions?
No. What we have of that third mission is, because remember, they came back in, well, actually, I didn't tell you this, so I will tell you that they came back in their small boats. They kept waiting in that summer of 1597 with the third voyage. They kept waiting for the ice to thaw so that they could get their ship out, because it was so much safer to sail home than to try to take their small boats. But in the end, they were in really bad shape, and they decided they needed to leave then or they would never be able to leave. So they ended up going out in just their small craft, a little bigger than a Zodiac, but with a sail, if you've ever been out on the water yourself. And it was a really rocky and precarious voyage. So they tied up some information and left it in basically a container for gunpowder in the cabin that they had built, and they had some of that information with them. And so they made journals. There was a journal that Garrett DeVere, who is the sort of the seen as the author of the account of these three voyages, that he made. So we have a lot of the details from the ship's log, but then there's also just a lot of description of what happened with them. But we don't have intact ship's logs from all three voyages. It's just so long ago, a lot of that record has been lost. That was one of the really interesting challenges of writing the book.
No doubt. Yeah, you're trying to uncover information that hasn't been known well for a long time. Andrea Pitzer is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a journalist who relishes digging up history that has been forgotten by the world. She's written about William Barents and his three expeditions from the Netherlands to the Arctic in the 1590s in the book Icebound, Shipwrecked at the Edge of the World. You can join our conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's come back to that first mission with just the four ships working in two different routes. Was that because they disagreed on the route to take?
It was partly because there was disagreement, but it was also partly because there was it was not necessarily any plan to get to China with that expedition. So it really was seen to try to get as much of the lay of the land as possible. There was definitely a competitive feel between the two groups. There was a guy named Jan van Linschoten who was on one of the other boats, and we have his journals of the first two voyages. And it's obvious he doesn't care for Barents, and he takes every opportunity he can to sort of slight Barents. And so even if it wasn't directly that there was tremendous disagreement as the cause of why they went to two different directions, you can tell that the two groups felt quite competitive with each other. Each one wanted to find the route that would make it. And Barents had gotten stuck in the ice trying to go up above Nova Zembla and had to turn around, whereas on that first voyage, the southern route guys with Jan van Linschoten made it through this narrow strait that they knew they would have to get to the open sea. And then they saw open sea on the other side, and they decided that they would turn and go back and inform everybody in the Netherlands that they had found a good route. And so that's why on the second route, the second expedition, they did take that southern route, because that they had made it into the open sea. So they had made it farther than Barents had in terms of sort of seeing a way forward. So they sort of won that discussion in the first expedition, and that's why the second expedition was routed to the south.
I'm struck by the similarities in the things that Barents thought about Nova Zembla as he went further north, and the things that Columbus has recorded as having said about Cuba, that both of them were sure that this was just a peninsula off of China, or of something close to that with Barents anyway.
Well, yeah, they really had this. I mean, when you and I think of Asia now, we think of this incredibly long. I mean, I think Russia has like 9 time zones, and most of them are in Asia. And, you know, it's this huge, huge landmass. But they had a visual in their head that just was off, and they really thought they would kind of get past Nova Zembla and then go a little further to where they had heard there were these couple rivers and go around this jut of land, and then they would just drop straight south to China. Well, they were off by more than 1,000 miles. I mean, and more than 1,000 miles of really, really tough sailing. And let me just emphasize, too, that like even that second expedition, the ice that they would see was just staggering. I mean, psychologically, physically, it was just so taxing to deal with. It would be taller so that, you know, you couldn't see the next ship that had just been right next to you. The ice would come between you and the other ship, and the ice would be so huge you would lose sight of everything. They would get stuck in ice mazes. They would try to take these hand drills. Think of just like a giant corkscrew, basically, and have to try to, like, chop open this ice to try to hack a way through for their boats. And then they might wake up the next morning and find themselves frozen in from behind, the way that they had just come, and then they couldn't move at all. And meanwhile, anytime they're close to land, there's polar bears coming after them. So just the sort of harrowing nature of trying to advance mile by mile, day after day, in this terrain, almost year-round, was just, you know, it was almost impossible.
Talk about the encounters with the polar bears, the first ones, because these are not creatures these guys from the Netherlands had ever seen before, I gather.
No, they had never seen these white bears before, and I suspect some of them might not have seen bears at all, because, to tell you, the renderings from the illustrators in the early days were, they don't look like bears at all. They look sort of like giant white dogs. And it's the same thing with the walruses, that it was clear that these were just really confusing animals for them. But the first one they see is on the first expedition, and it's in the water. And they have this idea that they're going to sort of fish it out and take it back to Amsterdam. And now some of them must have seen bears, because they mentioned that, like, that there are, you know, dancing bears, kind of pet bears, that are on the streets there. And they have this idea that's what they're going to do with this polar bear. Well, it's clear that they had never met a polar bear before, because they're huge, they are incredible fighters, and they're very, very aggressive. And so they did manage to get a rope looped around the animal's neck, and they thought they would sort of drag it and wear it out for a while. And because they were hitting it with axes, they were shooting it, they were doing all this stuff. And then they thought, well, we'll wear it out, and that'll take care of it. And then the bear decides it's going to climb in the boat. So it hauls itself up, and it's really only the rope getting stuck around the rudder of the boat, of the small boat that they're in, that keeps the bear from getting into the boat with them completely. So it's kind of stuck there on a leash, if you will, straining at the leash. And then finally the men realize, like, this is not going to work as a pet. They're going to have to kill it, and that this is their only chance to kill it while it's sort of held restrained this way. And still it takes several guys. I mean, the stories of these guys dealing with polar bears, especially when they at first don't know how to deal with them, I mean, it's 2 hours and, like, six guys fighting one bear, and they're armed with weapons, but a lot of the blades just break. You know, these are not quite the industrial blades of today. But still, just incredibly fierce combat, and they're huge. And so they just, it's terrifying, it's a new thing. But it is interesting that their first instinct with all these animals that they meet, and particularly the bears, is to capture it or kill it. And often, you know, killing is what they default to. And it doesn't reflect necessarily real well on them, because they're not just always in a defensive position. They get pretty interested in offensively killing the bears.
Yeah, bears and walruses too. They had they never seen walruses before either, I gather.
No, they hadn't, and it was really interesting, because I did three expeditions myself for the trip, and the third expedition I did was actually to the ruins of their cabin up on northern Nova Zembla in the book. And right at the place in the journal near the Orange Islands, where in the book these guys see, Barents and his men see hundreds of walruses, is right exactly where we came around these islands, and there were hundreds of walruses. It was really eerie, like 400 years later, in just the same place, and we came to them. And what Barents and his men did was, they had not seen them before, but they recognized by the tusks what these were, because they had heard that the tusks were incredibly valuable. So their thought is, they're going to go kill as many of these animals as they can to get their tusks. And they go out and they start hacking at them. Well, walrus hide is even harder to penetrate than polar bear, breaking all their weapons, and they only have one gun. So they think, well, we'll go back and get all our guns, and we'll come back and we'll slaughter all these guys. And then they get attacked by a polar bear. They get derailed and all that. But so they only come away with a few tusks. But the immediate plan was, let's kill all of them and break off their tusks and take them home. But what's interesting is, we, of course, did not have the same impulse when I sailed there. And instead, we had an accordion player with us, and he ended up playing a concert for the walruses. So I can tell you that if you don't attack them, the walruses are a lot nicer to you than they were to Barents and his men, because walruses are pretty formidable fighters, too.
And apparently, like some humans, they're not allergic to accordions.
I have had many people make accordion jokes that they would have, that would have been a fighting effort for them if they had been forced to listen to an accordion concert.
I am not at all surprised.
The walruses appeared to enjoy it.
So you mentioned going to the site of Barents's overwintering cabin from that 1596-97 expedition at the north end of Nova Zembla, Novaya Zemlya in Russian. And now I noticed that the crew members said it's a good idea to eat before you get on the ship. Why was that?
They said eat before we get away from land because you're not going to feel like eating for a few days. And it turned out that they were correct. It's you have all that warm water coming over from over Scandinavia, sort of the remnants of the North Atlantic, you know, what we think of as the Gulf Stream coming up and around and over. And then you have all this cold water from the other side, the Kara Sea. And they do what's, it's an erp factor, as you would say, in the middle, and it makes it very unstable. It's called the Devil's Dance Floor by some people.
Devil's Dance Floor. Oh, man, that's a great name for it. But so, you know, and the cabin itself, there is some of it still left there. And I keep forgetting that when we're talking about really cold places, we're talking essentially cryogenic preservation for what's there. It seems like in a temperate zone, any evidence of the cabin would have been long gone. But here it is, 400 plus years later.
Well, amazingly, for the first three centuries or so, very little happened to it because it was pretty sturdily built. And as you said, I mean, if everything's just frozen year-round, the ice and snow pile up, and then maybe they melt away some, but that's as much as is going on. So when it was finally located again and identified in the late 1800s, hundreds of artifacts were pulled out of it and are in various museums that I went around the world to see so I could touch the things that these guys had touched. So beer taps, leather shoes, books, you know, prints, picture prints, I mean, just stuff that we're going to trade with China, pewter candles, plates, all these amazing artifacts are visible today. And so most of it's been taken away from, you know, there since then. And that's probably good because it's a little more temperate than it used to be. So now there, you know, there isn't the same kind of ice and snow. When we were there, it was only a few days earlier than Barents had been stuck in. He got stuck in there in the ice in late August, if you can believe it. Whereas we were there today, there was very little in the way of ice and snow, except where there were actual glaciers, but most of the terrain there wasn't. And so there's a few the main timbers of it that are still on the site. And I have an archaeological map of the place, so I could know exactly where the cabin was and which way things were oriented, and I could go through the site. But it really gives you an amazing feeling to be not too far from the water and looking out and just seeing what it would be like if nobody knew you were on this place. They were off every map that had ever been made. You make this cabin for yourselves. People are dying. Everybody's sick. You have to hike miles to even get driftwood for firewood to have a hope of staying alive. And at night, of course, this is the winter there, at, you know, pretty early on, even though it's not meteorological winter, it's basically winter there. So the snow is going up over the sides of their cabin. And at night, the bears, you know, can walk on the roof. And at one point, a bear is rampaging, trying to get into the cabin from overhead to where they are. I mean, just really a desolate place to imagine being there in their circumstances.
Wow, that is amazing. Let's take some phone calls from our listeners. Jacob and Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Andrea Pitzer, the author of Icebound. Jacob, you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, yeah, we're here.
Yeah, I want to point out a major misconception of geography that's akin to thinking that the world was flat. But even today, we're taught in grade school that there's seven continents. But there was a major error, and it's all due to about 500 years ago in this age of cartography. But Europe is not a continent. If you look at a map, you see that Europe is sort of roughly triangular shaped with a wide base pointed to Asia. And it's actually part of the Asian landmass, or some people would call it Eurasia. But going from the Netherlands, or let's say if you were at the in France or the English Channel, you could walk across Asia and not hit any major land barrier till you hit Shanghai. You know, it's a supercontinent. Mm-hmm. But the European cartographers defined the line of Europe as Ural Mountains, and the Ural Mountains are a set of mountains that are linear longitudinal, but they're no bigger than the Cascade Range or the Allegheny Mountains. They're pretty unimpressive. Mm-hmm. But the problem why this persisted was 500 years ago, the Europeans were self-important. They thought of a Eurocentric world, and they thought Europe should be included as a major, you know, geographic feature as a continent. And so they made Europe a continent. Among, others, they wrote the maps, they made the maps, they drew the globes. So Europe became a continent. It's imaginary.
All right. So if you're at the seat of an empire, you want to make sure that the empire is well reflected in the world at large by size, I guess. Andrea, what do you know about the Eurocentric nature of European explorers of this age and how it played into their explorations?
Well, it certainly played into it. Well, those are two things. One I'll say about the land route. It was understood there was this land route. But that's a pretty tough go. And, that China had been trading with the West in one form or another for quite a long time. What these guys were looking for was to hopefully do it by sea and cut that agonizing long, long voyage so that it could be a real regular exchange of goods, just a freight line moving all the time with a ton of stuff happening. So that was the goal, was how can we do this by water? But what I will say about the sort of Eurocentric nature of these guys is less that they didn't acknowledge Asia or its importance or China and its importance than they really could have taken some cues from some of the indigenous people that they ran into that they didn't seem to learn from. And so I would say that there was definitely a sort of an European bravado. We have accounts of and even drawings of them making fox fur hats. They trapped foxes and ate them, which might be because of a little bit of the vitamin C that had the foxes had, the only thing that kept them dying from scurvy that winter. But we know they made hats out of that. But they don't ever seem, we have no pictures and no indications that they ever used polar bear pelts to warm themselves or make warmer clothing. And they didn't really have what we think of as heavy, Arctic winter clothing. They didn't even have that. They wore calf-length pants, and they had these tights, and they had heavy jackets, but nothing that you would need to overwinter in the Arctic. And yet they don't seem to have sort of followed the lead of some of the people that they ran into, the Nenets herders, and used the stuff that was available to make climate-appropriate clothing for themselves. So they probably could have been a little more humble about that.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, that the mixture of scientific knowledge. I mean, obviously, they were heading this way because they knew the world was round. I mean, that's pretty well established. They had a sense of latitude, knowing that things would get colder as they went further north, but also thought, well, maybe there's warmer water beyond there. The idea of distance, particularly east and west, as we've already pointed out, they were off by thousands of miles and figuring that Nova Zembla was, just a hop and a skip from China once they could get to the far side of it. But as you point out in the book, you give some good context here where this is sort of between the time that people came up with the idea that, yeah, it looks like we revolve around the sun and not the other way around, and the later confirmations of that. So this is an interesting period where we're sort of stuck in between some very old and rude beliefs and modern science.
Yeah, it's interesting. They could really accurately determine longitude, so how far north or south of the equator you are. I mean, they could get that down to really
latitude.
Precise degree. Latitude. They could do their latitude with a really precise degree. But with longitude, you need, from a moving ship, is really tricky. And it doesn't come around to be able to measure that for a long time. If you haven't read David Sobel's book, Longitude, it's really good. And so there were times when they were between Norway and the North Pole, and they had actually discovered this new island, Spitsbergen, that's now part of Svalbard. And they thought maybe they were in Greenland. And they knew what latitude they were at, but they really didn't know east and west where they were. So in some ways they had very precise tools, and in some ways they didn't know at all what they were doing. But one of the things I found amazing about them was that even though they were sort of in that middle ground, as you were saying, they very often functioned as scientists up there. They saw this optical phenomenon, a mirage, called the Nova Zembla effect today, that people for centuries thought they must have exaggerated or lied, or maybe the whole journal should be discredited, because they recorded seeing the sun come up 2 weeks early in 1597, and they couldn't figure out why. They had their solar tables, they knew when they should be able to see it, and it was just there, and it was there early. And then later, Nansen, actually, in the 21st century, saw it, or right at the turn of the 20th century, not the 21st century for sure, right at the turn of the 20th century, happened to observe it himself. And then suddenly people were acknowledging and realizing that this had been a real thing. And there had been debate about it for some time, but it's just this like temperature inversion layer, and basically the sun kind of gets reflected and bounced over the horizon even while it's still below the horizon. But these were the first guys to record this in history. They made all kinds of bird observations. They were always recording the height and the size of the animals that they saw. We really have a tremendous amount of information about the Arctic from that time because of what they logged. So even though this was before a lot of what we think of as the scientific revolution, they were kind of acting in that role, even though I don't think they would have seen themselves as scientists at all.
Well, give us a sense of the contrast between the Arctic of then and the Arctic of now, because you were up there. You visited the cabin site where the people that Barents had taken on his third expedition had to overwinter, and mentioned already that it's a bit more temperate now. Things have changed. It's not as icy. I mean, and you know, here we're talking about they did their sailing generally in June and July because they wanted to make sure they were there when the water was the warmest, the ice the least. But now, what does it look like?
It's completely different now. Again, the geography is the same. The walruses would like to hang out at the same spot from 400 years ago, for sure. But even the geography is getting affected. There was a glacier that had retreated so far that there was this whole island that had just sort of been discovered when I sailed up in that region, and that we hadn't known it was there because it had been covered by ice before that. You know, these guys, the ice was so horrific that on the second voyage they mutinied. You know, they just could not deal with the nature of it. And when I was up there, it was just ground. And in the winter, of course, there would be snow and ice, but now there's almost nothing. And one of the things that I say in the book is that passage that Barents was seeking is now opening up, and it's expected in the next 30 years or so, that maybe sooner, that the North Pole will be free of ice in the summer. And he could have made that voyage, but he just sailed 400 years too soon.
Wow. So what do you think of the fact that we've had things like, was it Verkhoyansk last summer, getting to 100 degrees in Siberia?
I have been up and covered, I did a story for the Washington Post about the sort of climate change at the northernmost town of the world and stuff that they thought was going to be frozen forever. All their infrastructure, their pipelines, their roads, everything was built with this idea that it was permafrost, right? It's never going to thaw. And now it's thawing and melting, and there's mudslides. And I just think that it would really behoove us to attend to some of this because, you know, the planet is changing and the Arctic is changing even faster than these lower latitudes. But what's happening there is a glimpse of some of the stuff that we're going to really need to be dealing with.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the legacy of Barents, I mean, as you point out, he might have been right hundreds of years later, based on climate change. But it sounds like the artifacts, as you mentioned, distributed in museums throughout the world, that there's a fair amount of knowledge about his mission. You've collected it all in one place here. But did he push the boundaries in ways that helped people later?
Certainly mapping the Mediterranean even before he left. This was farther north in the Arctic than anybody had ever gone. And so it solved all kinds of questions that we didn't know about that whole part of the world. Was there a polar continent? Was there ice all the way up? The idea that you could survive a winter in this place was staggering to people. I mean, he came back, and like I mentioned, there was Shakespeare, and Nabokov has written about him. He's been referred to in Salman Rushdie's book, and Jules Verne and the Bronte sisters. This idea of the intrepid far north really came back to us in a lot of ways because of Barents's voyage. Particularly that third one, all three of them to a degree, but especially the third one. And he kind of became the first face of what we now think of as these polar explorers who suffer so much just to get a little farther north.
Was the Barents Sea named after him as a memorial? I mean, I assume it was named after his death.
It was named, but it was more than 100 years after. It came to be known that. I think it's a little bit more of what your caller suggested about the sort of European self-importance. Of course, it had another name that the Russians used before that, but Barents is the one that got the name that would stick. But it's a pretty incredible feat to have gone back and forth across it, and the fact that he lost his life on the Barents Sea. He had just come around from the Kara Sea when he died, but I don't want to ruin for your readers the moment that happens. It's kind of dramatic.
Okay.
But yeah, it's memorialized for him.
All right. The book is called Icebound, Shipwrecked at the Edge of the World. Andrea Pitzeritz, author, our guest. Andrea, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
All right. Take care.